You tuned in to the Voice of the Narrated Puritan podcast. We are doing a study of the practical works of John Owen in Volume 6, in Volume 7 of his works. And I want, before I deal any more with the mortification of sin, take a look at what is the nature of indwelling sin. And that, really, I was most helped by Chapter 5 of a treatise on indwelling sin, and that is indwelling sin has its root in enmity against God, and from that, it gains its power. It admits of no peace nor rest, and is against God Himself. In a treatise on the religious affections by Archibald Alexander, it says that religion which God requires and will accept does not consist in weak, dull, and lifeless wishes, raising us but a little above a state of indifference. God in His Word rather greatly insists upon it that we be in good earnest, fervent in spirit, and our hearts vigorously engaged in religion. Romans 12, verse 11, "Be you fervent in spirit, serving the Lord," end quote. He then says if we are not in good earnest in our Christian profession and our wills and inclinations are not strongly exercised, we are nothing. The things of religion are so great that there can be no suitableness in the exercises of our hearts to their nature and importance unless they be lively and powerful, and nothing is vigor in the actings of our inclinations so requisite is in a Christian profession, and in nothing is lukewarmness so odious. A true Christian profession is evermore a powerful thing, and the power of it appears in the first place in the inward exercises of it in the heart, where is the principal and original seed of it. So true Christianity is called the power of godliness, in distinction from the external appearances of it, that are the form of it, 2 Timothy 3, verse 5. Having a form of godliness, but denying the power of it. The Spirit of God in those that have sound and solid Christianity is a spirit of powerful affection, and therefore God is said to have given the spirit of power and of love and of a sound mind, 2 Timothy 1, verse 7. And the experience of Sarah Edwards, as it was recorded by Cyrano Dwight, quote, "While Mr. Reynolds was at prayer in the family this morning, I felt an earnest desire that in calling on God he should say, Father, or that he should address the Almighty under that appellation, on which the thought turned in my mind, why can I say, Father? Can I now, at this time, with the confidence of a child and without the least misgiving of heart, call God my Father? It's brought to my mind two lines of Ralph Erskine's sonnet. I see him lay his vengeance by and smile in Jesus' face. I was thus deeply sensible that my sins did loudly call for vengeance, but I then saw by faith God lay his vengeance by and smile in Jesus' face. It appeared to be real and certain that he did so. I had not the least doubt that he then sweetly smiled upon me with a look of forgiveness and love, having laid aside all his displeasure towards me for Jesus' sake, which made me feel very weak and somewhat faint. In consequence of this, I felt a strong desire to be alone with God, to go to him, without having anyone to interrupt the silent and soft communion which I earnestly desired between God and my own soul, and accordingly withdrew to my chamber." End quote. In a letter of John Newton, dated March 1772, on the subject of indwelling sin, he wrote, quote, "I think my last letter turned upon the apostle thought in Galatians 5, verse 17. You cannot do the things that you would. In a parallel place, Romans 7, verse 19, there is another clause subjoined, the evil which I would not do, that I do." Now, if you add this to the former, it would complete the dark side of my experience. Permit me to tell your lordship a little part, for some things must not, cannot be told, not of what I have read, but of what I have felt, in illustration of this passage. I would not be the sport and prey of wild, vain, foolish, and vile imaginations, but this evil is present with me. My heart is like an open highway, like a city without walls or gates. Nothing so false, so frivolous, so absurd, so impossible, or so horrid, but it can obtain access, and that at any time or in any place. Neither in my study, the pulpit, nor even at the Lord's table am I exempted from their intrusion. But if this awful effect of heart depravity cannot be wholly avoided in the present state of human nature, yet at least I would not allow and indulge it. Yet, this I find I do. In defiance of my best judgment and best wishes, I find something within me which cherishes and cleaves to those evils from which I ought to be horrified by and flee from, as if a toad or a serpent was put in my food or in my bed. Ah, how vile must a heart, at least my heart, be, that can hold a parley with such abominations when I so well know their nature and their tendency. Surely he who finds himself capable of this may, without the least affectation of humility, however fair his outward conduct appears, subscribe himself less than the least of all saints and the very chief of sinners. I would not be influenced by a principle of self on any occasion, yet this evil I often do. End quote. Now let us take a look at a treatise on indwelling sin by John Owen. Chapters 4 and 5, The Problem of Indwelling Sin. From a conference talk called The Problem of Indwelling Sin, Westminster Conference, December 11, 2001, Will Timmons says, "The fact that the nature of indwelling sin is enmity against God shows that it is powerful. The nature of indwelling sin is that it is always enmity against God. That is the unchangeable nature of sin. So it cannot be pacified in any way, and so we cannot expect quietness from our corruptions by satisfying them. That is the equivalent to satisfying a fire by adding fuel to it." John Owen says indwelling sin is never satisfied because it is enmity against God, and therefore the only relief of the soul is in sin's ruin. No terms of peace are possible. This enmity against God is universal to all of God. That explains why there is a greater enmity against God in the gospel than in the law, because more of the glorious excellencies of God are manifested in the gospel than in the law. And this enmity against God is universal in all of the soul. The mind, the will, and the affections are all secured against God. This enmity operates in two ways. First, by aversion, which is a turning away, a drawing away from God. And secondly, by opposition. John Owen first considers the aversion of sin before moving on to its opposition. Then in taking up the theme of opposition, he breaks it down under two heads, sin's force and sin's deceit. The reader needs to know at this point that though he is beginning to descend into the depths of Owen's subdivision, when he gets to the discussion of its force and deceit, he has in fact reached the heart of John Owen's analysis. An argument's location in the order of John Owen's system of divisions is not an indication of its importance in his line of argument, and in this lies no small part of its power, which we are inquiring after. It can admit of no terms of peace, of no composition. There may be a composition where there is no reconciliation. There may be a truce where there is no peace. But with this enemy, indwelling sin, we can obtain neither the one nor the other. It is never quiet, whether it is conquering or conquered, which is the only kind of enemy that the famous warrior complained of old. It is in vain for a man to have any expectation of rest from his lust, but by its death, an absolute freedom from it by his own death. Some of the agitating of their corruption seek for quietness by laboring to satisfy them, making provision for the flesh to fulfill the lust thereof, as the apostle speaks. Romans 13, verse 14. This is to try to put out a fire by adding wood and oil to it. Is all the fuel in the world, all the fabric of the creation that is combustible being cast into the fire will not at all satisfy it, but increase it. So is it with satisfaction given to sin by giving in to sin? It doth but inflame and increase. If a man will part with some of his goods to an enemy, it may satisfy him, but enmity will have all, and is not one whit the more satisfied than if he had received nothing at all, like the lean cattle that were nevertheless hungry for having devoured the fat. You cannot bargain with the fire to take but so much of your houses. You have no way but to quench it. You have to put the fire out. It is in this case as it is in the contest between a wise man and a fool, Proverbs 29, verse 9. Whether he rage or laugh, there is no rest. Whatever frame or temper he be in, his importunate folly makes him troublesome. It is so with this indwelling sin, whether it violently agitate, as it will do on provocations and temptations, it will be outrageous in the soul, or whether it seem to be pleased and contented, to be satisfied all as one, there is no peace, no rest to be had with it, or by it. Had it then been of any other nature, some other way might have been fixed on, but seeing it consists in enmity, all the relief the soul has must lie in its ruin. Secondly, indwelling sin. It is not only said to be enmity, but it is said to be enmity against God. It is chosen a great enemy indeed. It is in a number of places proposed as our enemy, 1 Peter 2:11. Abstain from fleshly lusts which war against the soul. Dear enemies to the soul, that is to ourselves. Sometimes as an enemy to the spirit that is in us, the flesh lusts or fights against the spirit. Galatians 5 verse 17. It fights against the spirit or the spiritual principle that is in us to conquer it. It fights against our souls to destroy them. It has special ends and designs against our souls and against the principle of grace that is in us. But its proper formal object is God. It is enmity against God. It is its work to oppose grace. It is a consequence of its work to oppose our souls, which follows on what it does more than what it intends. But its nature and formal design is to oppose God. God is a lawgiver. God is holy. God is the author of the gospel, a way of salvation by grace and not by works. This is the direct object of the law of sin. Why does it oppose duty so that the good we would do, we do not, either as to the matter or manner of it? Why does it render the soul carnal, indisposed, unbelieving, unspiritual, weary, and wandering? It is because of its enmity to God, whom the soul aims to have communion with in duty. It has, as it were, that command from Satan which the Assyrians had from their king, fight, neither with small nor great, save only with the king of Israel, 1 Kings 22, verse 31. It is thus also in respect of all propensity to sin, as well as opposition to God. It is God himself that is aimed at. It is true, the pleasures, the wages of sin greatly influence the sensual carnal affections of men, but it is the holiness and authority of God that sin itself rises up against. It hates the yoke of the Lord. You have been weary of me, Isaiah 43, verse 22. God says to sinners, and that during their performance of an abundance of duties, every act of sin is a fruit of being weary of God. Thus Job tells us what lies at the bottom in the heart of sinners. They say unto God, depart from us. Job 21 verse 14. It is enmity against him, an antipathy to him. Here lies the formal nature of every sin. It is an opposition to God, a casting off of his yoke, of breaking off the dependence that the creature ought to have on the Creator. And the Apostle gives a reason why he affirms the carnal mind is enmity against God, namely because it is not subject to the law of God. Neither indeed can it be, Romans 8, verse 7. It never is, nor will, nor can be subject to God. Its whole nature consists in an opposition to Him. The soul in which it is may be subject to the law of God, but this law of sin sets up in disagreement to it. It will not be in subjection. And it is not just enmity against God, John Owen says. It's against all of the attributes of God. The enmity of indwelling sin is universally against all of God. If there were anything of God, His nature, properties, His mind or His will, His law or gospel, any duty of obedience to Him or of communion with Him, that sin had not an enmity against, the soul might have a constant shelter and retreat within itself. By applying itself to that of God, to that of duty towards Him, to that of communion with Him, which sin would make no opposition against. But the enmity lies against God, and all of God, and everything or by which we have to do with Him. It is not subject to the law, nor any part or parcel of it, word or tittle of the law. The nearer, if I may so say, anything is to God, the greater is its enmity to it. The more of spirituality and holiness is in anything, the greater is its enmity. That which has most of God has most of its opposition. Concerning them in whom this law of sin is most predominant, God says, "You have set at naught all my counsel, and with none of my reproof." Proverbs 1:25. Not this or that part of God's counsel, mind, or will is opposed, but all of His counsel, whatever He calls for or guides to, and every particular of it. All is said at naught, and nothing of its reproof is attended to. Now in chapter 5, this aversion manifests itself in a battle to have devotions to God. A secret striving will be in them to want to have private devotions about close and cordial dealing with God. Unless the hand of God and His Spirit be high and strong upon the soul, even when convictions or a sense of your spiritual duty, dear and real esteem of God and communion with Him, have carried the soul into the prayer closet, yet if there is not the vigor and power of a spiritual life constantly at work, there will be a secret loathness in them to this kind of spiritual duty. Yea, sometimes there will be a violent inclination to the contrary, so that the soul had rather do anything, embrace any diversion, though it gets wounded by it, than vigorously apply itself to that which in the inward man it breathes after. It is weary before it begins and says, "When will this work be over?" Here God and the soul are immediately concerned, and it is a great conquest to do what we would, though we come exceedingly short of what we should do. Richard Alleyne, the Puritan, uncle of Joseph Alleyne, the author of An Alarm to the Unconverted, says in a book called Heaven Opened on the new heart that is promised in the covenant, the groans that are felt in this indisposedness to spiritual duty because of the remains of indwelling sin in the heart. Quote, "Oh, what sorrow-bitten souls are the saints for their lack of sorrow. I mourn, Lord. I lament. I weep. But it is because I cannot mourn or lament as I should. If I could mourn as I ought, I could be comforted. If I could weep, I could rejoice. If I could sigh, I would sing. If I could lament, I could live. I die. I die. My heart dies within me, because I cannot cry. I cry, Lord, but not for sin, but for tears for sin. I cry, Lord, my calamities cry, my bones cry, my soul cries, my sins cry, Lord, for a broken heart. And behold, yet I am not broken. The rocks rend, the earth quakes, the heavens drop, the clouds weep, the sun will blush, the moon be ashamed, the foundations of the earth will tremble at the presence of the Lord, but this heart of mine will neither break nor tremble. Oh, for a broken heart, if this were once done, might my soul have this wish. Thenceforth my God might have his will. What would be difficult if my heart were tender? Labor would be easy. Pains would be a pleasure. Burdens would be light. Neither the command nor the cross would be any longer grievous. Nothing would be hard but sin. Fear, where art thou? Come and plow up this rock. Love, where art thou? Come and thaw this ice. Come and warm this dead lump. Come and enlarge this straitened spirit. Then I shall run in the way of his commandments. End quote. John Owen says, prevent the beginnings. Labor to prevent the very beginnings of the working of this aversion to God. Let grace be beforehand with it in every duty. We are directed to watch unto prayer. 1 Peter 4, verse 7. And as it is to prayer, so to every duty. Let us consider and take care that we be not hindered from within nor from without as a due performance of every duty. Watch against temptations to oppose them. Watch against the aversion that is in sin, to prevent it. As we are not to give place to Satan, no more are we to sin. If it is not prevented in its first attempts, it will prevail. My meaning is, whatever good we have to do, as the Apostle speaks in Romans 7, verse 21, and find evil is present with us, we must prevent its negotiating with the soul, its cleverly asserting its poison into the mind and affections. Do this by a vigorous, holy, and violent stirring up of the grace, or graces, that are to be acted and set at work, peculiarly in that duty, end quote. Now, in order to assist us in purging us from the remains of indwelling sin, Christians are often subjected to difficult trials. Archibald Alexander in Thoughts on Religious Experience says, for your more rapid growth in grace, some of you will be cast into the furnace of affliction, sickness, bereavement, bad conduct of your children and relatives, loss of property or of reputation may come upon you unexpectedly and press heavily on you. In these trying circumstances, exercise patience and fortitude. Be more solicitous to have the affliction sanctified than removed. Glorify God while in the fire of adversity. That faith, which is most tried, is commonly most pure and precious. Learn from Christ how you ought to suffer. Let perfect submission to the will of God be aimed at. Never indulge a murmuring or discontented spirit. Repose with confidence on the promises. Commit all of your cares to God. Commenting on 1 Peter 4, verse 18, the Puritan Robert Leighton wrote, and if the righteous scarcely are saved, where shall the ungodly and the sinner appear? It is true, then, that the righteous are scarcely saved. Even they that endeavor to walk uprightly in the ways of God, that is, the righteous, they are scarcely saved. This doesn't mean that there is uncertainty or hazard in the thing itself. It's to the end of it, in respect of the purpose and performance of God, but only to greet difficulties and hard encounters in the way. Did they go through so many temptations and tribulations, so many fightings without and fears within? The Christian is so simple and weak, and his enemies are so crafty and powerful. The oppositions of the wicked world, their hatred and scorns and molestations, the slights and violence of Satan, and worst of all, the strength of his own corruptions. And by reason of abounding corruption, there is such a frequent, almost continual need of purifying by afflictions and trials, that he has need to be still under this kind of a medicine, and is of necessity at sometimes drained and brought so low, that there is scarcely strength or life remaining in him. And truly all outward difficulties would be but manner of ease. It would be as nothing were it not for the encumbrance of lusts and corruptions within. Were a man to meet disgrace and sufferings for Christ, how easily would he go through them, yea, and rejoice in them, were he rid of this fretting impatience, this pride and self-love of his own carnal heart. These clog and trouble him worse, and he cannot shake them off, nor prevail against them without much pains, many prayers and tears, and many times after much wrestling he scarcely finds that he has gained any ground. Yea, sometimes he is foiled and cast down by them. And so in all our other duties, such a fighting and continual combat with a revolting, backsliding heart, the flesh still pulling and dragging downwards. When he would mount up, he finds himself as a bird with a stone tied to its foot. He has wings that flutter to be upwards, but is pressed down by the weight fastened to him. What struggling with wanderings and deadness in heart and reading and prayer. And what is most grievous is that by their unwary walking and the prevailing of some corruption they grieve the Holy Spirit of God and provoke him to hide his face and withdraw his comforts. How much pain to attain anything, any particular grace of humility or meekness or self-denial. And if anything is attained, how hard to keep it and maintain it against the contrary disposition. How often are they driven back to their old point, if they do but cease from striving a little, they are carried back by the stream. And what returns of doubtings and misbelief after they thought they were gotten somewhat above them, and so much that sometimes they are at the point of giving over and thinking it will never be for them, and yet through all these they are brought safe home. There is another strength in theirs which bears them up and brings them through. But these things and many more of this nature argue the difficulty of their course and that it is not so easy a thing to come to heaven, humanly speaking, as most imagine it, end quote. The following letter is from J.C. Philpott to Joseph Perry, dated November 8, 1837. My dear friend, if you measure me by yourself, you will not conceive writing letters so pleasant a task as to expect two of me before I return to Ellington. And then he goes on to say, I don't think the hearers in our congregations can be fair judges of their ministers. They, of course, think of themselves, and if they hear well and love a minister, they want to keep them all to themselves. The minister, on the other hand, where he feels life and a blessing to attend his ministry, is drawn to that place, and where he meets a hungry people is willing to give them such food as he has. And I dare say, we wanderers contract a roving disposition and like change. This is the part I wanted to focus in on, though. He says, popularity has its dangers, charms, and large congregations please the carnal mind. But I think, I am so well weighted and ballasted by temptations and sins that popularity has less charms for me than for many. A man full of evil, and that continually has not much to be proud of, and his fears lest God should stop his mouth or cut him down for his presumption. As a farmer, you are not very proud of your diseased lambs, and as a preacher, I cannot be very proud of my diseased prayers and sin-stained sermons. Neither can I boast much of my daily backslidings, hardness of heart, discontent, vileness, and abominable filthiness. I at times know not what will become of me, and I fear I shall live and die a reprobate. I find sin has such power over me, and though I call on the Lord again and again for deliverance, seem to be as weak as ever when the temptation comes. Oh, thou hideous monster sin, what a course hast thou brought in. I love it. I hate it. I want to be delivered from the power of it, and yet I am not satisfied without drinking down its poison sweets. It is my hourly companion and my daily curse, the breath of my mouth and the cause of my groans, my incentive to prayer and my hinderer of it. It makes a Savior suffer. It makes a Savior precious. It spoils every pleasure and adds a sting to every pain. It fits a soul for heaven and ripens a soul for hell. Friend Joseph, can you make out my riddle? It's your heart. It's my heart, said one of old, and come up into my chariot. We shall quarrel, by the way, unless, as in water, face answers to face, so does the heart of man to man. I believe I shall never live and die a Pharisee, and must come in amongst us sinners. To ragged regiments of adulterous Davids, idolatrous Manasses, swearing Peters, persecuting Sauls, fornicating Corinthians, railing thieves and self-abhorring publicans. Pardon to the innocent is a word of six letters, and that is all. Redemption to the self-saved is a Bible term, no more. And some of them say it is a universal term, and others a particular term, and one quotes an Arminian and the other a Calvinistic text, and with these sticks they belabor one another's heads, while still lost. Sin-bitten bulrush, howling, half-desperate, ditch-plunged, black-hearted wretch, up to its neck in guilt, cries out for its individual application as his only remedy and only hope. I at times quite despair of salvation, and then again am as careless as if hell had no wrath, and heaven no love, as if sin had no wormwood and pardon no sweet, as if there were no God to mark evil and no devil to tempt to it. So, my friend, you must not expect to find your winter fireside companion much grown in progressive sanctification and creature holiness, end quote. John Owen, commenting on Paul saying, I find this law of sin warring in his members, this law of sin which the apostle affirms that he found in himself. This is a title that he gives to the powerful and effectual remainder of indwelling sin, even in believers. This is a state of most men in the world which makes them woefully despise all their eternal concerns they have not found out. This law of sin warring in their members. Why is it that men follow and pursue the world with so much greediness that they neglect heaven, life, and immortality for it every day? Why is it that some pursue their sensuality with delight? They will drink and revel and have their sports, let others say what they please. Why is it that so many live so unprofitably under the word, that they understand so little of what is spoken to them, that they practice less of what they understand, and will by no means be stirred up to answer the mind of God and his call to them? All these things proceed from this law of sin, and the power of it, which rules and bears sways in men. But follows that if there be such a law of sin in believers, it is doubtless their duty to find it out. To find it so to be, the more they are aware of its power, the less they will feel of its effects. It will not be to the advantage of any man to have a wasting fever, and not to discover it, or a fire lying secretly in his house, and not to know it. So much as men find of this law in them, so much they will abhor it in themselves, and no more. Proportional also to their discovery of it will be their earnestness for grace, nor will it rise higher. All watchfulness and diligence and obedience will be answerable also thereto. Upon this one hinge of finding out and experiencing the power and the efficacy of this law of sin turns the whole course of our lives. Ignorance of it breeds senselessness, carelessness, sloth, security, and pride. All which the Lord's soul abhors. Eruptions into great, open conscience-wasting, scandalous sins are from a lack of a due spiritual consideration of this law warring in their members. Inquire then, how is it with your souls? What do you find of this law? What experience have you of its power and efficacy? Do you find it dwelling in you, always present with you, exciting itself or putting forth its poison? At all times, in all your duties, when you would do good, what humiliation, what self-abasement, what intenseness in prayer, what diligence, what watchfulness does this call for at your hands? What spiritual wisdom do you stand in need of? What supplies of grace? What assistance of the Holy Spirit will there also be discovered? I fear we have few of us a diligence proportionable to our danger, end quote. Well, thank you for tuning in to the podcast of the Narrated Puritan. an examination of the practical works at this time of John Owen, Volume 6 and 7 of his collected works.